The Production Expert Podcast is brought to you with the kind support of Arturia, Avid, Source Elements, and RSBE Audio Solutions.
Welcome to the Production Expert Podcast. I'm Julian Rogers, and in this week's edition, Ashay and I are joined by Paul Maunder. We're going to be discussing some of the best advice, tips, and tricks we've learned during our audio and music careers to date. This is kind of a nice loose topic, actually. So this is, I'm quite looking forward to this. It feels like ages since I've been on a podcast. So, you know.
It has. It's been a while.
I know. For anyone who's noticed kind of like maybe a slightly different frequency of podcasts, this is a thing that we're doing at the moment. Should we call it kind of a resource issue? But we hope to come back to doing the old schedule soon. But for the time being, we're just kind of like, you know, we're slightly less frequent. I hope that's not affecting any of the listeners too much. But, you know, like I say, watch this space, because it's not supposed to be a permanent arrangement, but we're just kind of trying to catch up with, chaos.
Absolutely.
Right. So anyway, we should talk about this stuff. We're talking about, I don't know, we've got kind of like a pretty loose list. And we were going to start with workflow tips. Oops. Okay, there might have been an edit there because I just had what the UK might understand to be a Radio 4 moment. We'll try this again. We're going to be talking about workflow tips, shortcuts, and things you've discovered along the way. I'm going to start on this actually because I'm the one who's talking, and this is taking shortcuts very literally indeed, because we're kind of talking about kind of like workflow things here, but I'm going to talk about a keyboard shortcut actually. Anyone who hasn't seen the video that I did on the blog quite recently about controlling edit selections in Pro Tools, I know we're getting pretty specific off the bat here, but you know, bear with me. Arrow keys, and I did the little thing explaining how you can use those to make creating and managing shortcuts and navigating much easier. A really nice one that I didn't know for years and years and years is, I don't know about either of you, but do you have edit window scrolling, or the equivalent in Logic, switched on by default? Does it, when your cursor reaches the edge of the screen, does it then reset and start again? Yeah, I don't like that.
Yeah, I kind of switch it. I tend to go between no scrolling, you know, continuous scrolling, and then sometimes I switch it to page scrolling.
Never used continuous. Oof.
Right, yeah. I vary it. Okay. I don't have any fixed way of doing
Interesting.
It.
Interesting, really. Okay. Ashay, what about you? So playhead reaches right-hand edge and it starts again from left with new stuff showing.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, which is what I think an awful lot of people do. Why would you want to do no scrolling? Because kind of it can be quite useful if you're doing something, especially if you're editing on the fly, which is something I do quite a lot with dialogue. And if you're not quick enough, then basically it's a whoosh, and suddenly you can't see where you are anymore.
Yeah, that's annoying.
And it's yeah. So, but it's like, well, how do you get back to where you are? And it's this little shortcut, which in Pro Tools is a down arrow and right arrow. And what that does, as long as you've got it set up right, it's pretty default stuff. It's like linking timeline edit selections. Is it will center the playhead even if it's disappeared off to the right. So you can keep doing what you were doing, go, where was I? And I just sort of hit that as like a manual page scroll kind of like advanced thing. And yeah, it's just, I kind of take it for granted these days. But that really changed the way things work for me. So that's in that video. So if you haven't checked that video out, check it out. It's got a few things in it. But that's kind of like the Easter egg at the end of like, oh, and by the way, because I'd been using Pro Tools for years before someone showed me that. And I went, hey, that's cool. Mm. So that's a nice one, you know.
Yeah.
Someone else. It doesn't have to be a keyboard shortcut. It can be anything.
I mean, mine isn't really a shortcut per se because it takes a little bit more effort in the beginning, but it's better for the mix stage. It's better for the production stage in general, I find. And that's dynamic leveling within Melodyne itself. So basically they have these macro sliders and you can actually make the quieter notes louder and vice versa. So I do that first. And that way you don't have to sort of compress so hard.
Oh, okay. So like people do using like clip gain or the equivalent, but you can
do it in Melodyne. Yeah, you do it in Melodyne. And you can also do that with the de-essing as well and with breath. So I like to do that and just work really granularly within Melodyne so that I know the source material is perfect before processing it.
Is this within standalone Melodyne or in like ARI?
Yeah, with all of it, all of the Melodyne software.
You see, I don't know it very well, but that's cool. It's a little bit like the thing that you can do. You can do that with scaling MIDI velocities proportionally, and that's quite a cool thing to do. because it's kind of it's so benign, you know. Well, but yeah. Is it Melodyne? Is that like a thing for you, Paul?
Not really. No, I've used it creatively a couple of times, but you know, I think it's mostly a music thing, isn't it? Really,
I mean, it is really, but it's pretty powerful. So you know.
Yeah, so I have had a mess with it, and I've found some uses for it with strange sounding voices in a sound design kind of scenario. You know, where I've been pitching stuff to give it a kind of otherworldly feel, but on a day to day basis, it's not something I tend to use. You know,
unsurprising. I mean, it's a bit like I don't know. I have used spot mode in music production, for example, but like seriously not many times.
Yeah, there's kind of the stuff that's post specific and the stuff that's music specific, and if you do one or the other, then you probably don't really venture into the other territory too much. You know,
I mean, if you're making pop music, Melodyne is absolutely incredible. It's an incredible tool for not just vocals but guitars and everything, really.
I must admit, that's a massive knowledge gap for me, is Melodyne. I don't know it nearly well enough. I mean, I used it quite a lot a long time ago, kind of when Melodyne DNA first came out, which I don't even know when that is now. It's like 2008, 2009, something like that. I mean, like a really long time ago. No, it can't be that long ago. Anyway, whatever. No, good one. So where were we? We were with you, Paul?
So, yeah, shortcuts. I mean, I use quite a few shortcuts, really, because, I teach Pro Tools, and to teach it, I suppose you have to know quite a few shortcuts because they're in the course material. So I'll just give you a couple that I use on a regular basis. So one of them is, and I know you know this, Jules, the keyboard snapping shortcuts, the ones that allow you to snap a clip to the playhead. So for anyone who isn't familiar with the ones specifically in Pro Tools, if you've got the cursor part somewhere and you want to snap a clip to it, you hold down the control key, this is on the Mac, and then with the grabber tool, you click on the clip, the start of it moves to the cursor position. If you want to snap the end of the clip, it's control with command, and if you've got a sync point, which is a little identifying point within the clip, you want to snap that to the cursor. It's control and shift. Click it with the grabber. And it just speeds up a lot of the stuff I do, you know, because I'm frequently moving stuff to a particular point in sync with picture. And if, for example, I want to just align a sound effect with any given moment in the, you know, picture on screen, then that's just a really quick way of doing it. It's the fastest way.
Mm. On a sort of, I mean, this is loosely related, but one of those things that, I mean, I don't know why I didn't know this sooner, you know, and it's not recent, but you know what I mean? When you've kind of been using Pro Tools for a few years and then you go, oh, you can do that. And it's, you know, those real facepalm things is P and semicolon, just for moving the selector up and down vertically. That is endlessly useful, just because very often, I mean, especially if you're kind of, you know, shunting things around and trying to get things, you know, in sync and whatever. And there's all sorts of reasons why you can be wanting to do things like that. If you're trying to find a timing reference for something on a different track and then trying to fix stuff in time, then being able to get, I've got exactly this point here and I want to use that and, you know, exploit it on a different track, being able to go up and down vertically and knowing that you're not moving side to side. It's kind of one of those things you really have to know. But yeah, it was embarrassingly long time before I knew.
Yeah, I mean, you can easily, you know, no one's going to know every single feature of the software, and you'll just find stuff out over time, sometimes an extended period. But you mentioned about not moving stuff, you know, one way or another. If you know the one about constraining the movement, if you want to drag something to another track.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, hold down the control key and drag it, and it will prevent it from moving left or right. That's just something that it becomes such an inherent thing that you don't even think about, that it's almost like second nature. You know, it's just, you just do it and it happens.
So we've gone quite specific here. But yeah. Workflow tips, shortcuts, things you discovered along the way. In terms of workflow, as in just getting work done, it'd be quite nice to expand it out to that and just get away from those kind of, like, you know, really focused in on specific tasks things. Yeah. Perfect example for me might be something like the way I motivate myself to complete tasks.
How do you do that?
I mean, it usually involves self-bribery. You know, I mean, there's two things, actually. I mean, what I do is, everyone's got this, you know, how you can't work well under pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, if you're under pressure, then your ability to complete the work decreases with the increasing amount of pressure. So set yourself up so you've got a comfortable amount of work to do, and then the option of doing some more if you have time. So, I mean, I make myself a list. I'm a big fan of paper lists, actually. They're extremely short, but I think there's something quite tactile about just the joy of putting a line through something. I had a friend who used to write lists scrupulously. She's great for this. And this was the thing she picked up off her dad, which was item one on every list she wrote was always make list, so she could put a line through it straight away.
That's really satisfying, actually. I do that when I'm finishing a mix or a production and it's getting really sort of granular and annoying. Mm. I'll just write things on a post-it note and just say, do this and level these vocals, and then just sort of tick it off. And it feels really satisfying. And it also keeps your brain sort of focusing on what you have to do rather than finding more and more things to sort as well.
Yeah, so, yeah. And I mean, real basic stuff. I mean, it is kind of things as basic as, I'm going to finish this edit and it's going to take 20 minutes to get to the end of this, maybe, and then I'm going to have a cup of tea. You know what I mean? The role of tea in British culture, come on, you know. Mm. Yeah.
The role of tea. And that brings me to breaks as well. Like,
well, I don't think we're really kind of like selling anything people don't already know. That you go, hey, if you have a break, it's nice, but
it's not just nice. It's really important if you're mixing as well to gain perspective over things, because we can think that working for hours and hours, we're not losing perspective on how things sound, but you absolutely do. So taking a 20-minute break and making a cup of tea, which I do a lot, is really, really helpful for sort of just coming back to it, listening, and also referencing as well. I do this thing when I'm songwriting, not just mixing, but when I've written a song, for example, like the previous day and I really like it, or I've worked with a client and we're really happy, I'll listen first thing in the morning without a tea. So I'm really groggy and really sort of, you know, critical.
Bad-tempered and unforgiving.
Yes, bad-tempered, unforgiving. And if it still sounds good then I know that I can continue.
Oh, okay, all right.
Mm.
Nice.
What about you, Paul?
This might seem like a reasonably obvious one, but using templates is something which I do to try and speed up my workflow. You know, if you've got a regular method of doing something, for example, you always create certain tracks, you've always got certain routing, even certain plugins on the session, working off a template that you've created for yourself, you know, just means you don't have to do that process every single time. Anything that I can do to kind of cut down on time like that is worth doing.
That's interesting. So when you're doing that, I had a conversation about this recently, and I was never a big DAW template person. I really wasn't. And but I've changed my opinion since I've started doing Dolby Atmos mixes.
Right.
And suddenly it's like, oh, I need a template for this. I can't be doing with this. And just setting that stuff up every time. Completely change it. For stereo work, I think it's because there's nothing that complicated going on. And I'm quick at it. I can set up a session very quickly. And I quite like the idea of avoiding the habit. I mean, maybe it's just because it's something that I enjoy doing anyway.
In addition to actual session templates, I also sometimes use track presets. So if I don't want to do a full-on session that's templated, maybe I just want to recall certain attributes.
I was going to ask you about track presets, because they're so useful and I don't use them at all.
Right.
And I've proposed, hey, you could build a track preset to do this and it'd be really useful. And I think, am I going to do that? And I end up not doing it, in spite of it being a good idea. So examples, I mean, have you ever done ones with like groups of tracks and little configurations and stuff? Because you can do that. A track preset doesn't have to be a single track.
That's true. Yeah, you can. I haven't used it for that. Mostly I use it on individual tracks. And I'll tell you, the first one I set up shortly after these track presets came in, I realized, hang on a minute, whenever I do dialogue, I've always got a high pass filter and I've always got a compressor, and the compressor settings are broadly similar most of the time. Why don't I just create a track preset for this rather than forever recalling these settings and manually setting it up? So that was the first one. And again, it just saves you a little bit of time, and all that time across several days or sessions mounts up, really, doesn't it?
It really does add up, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ever wondered what it's like to mix an entire album for Kanye?
Or layering vocals for Chris Brown?
Join your hosts, Cash and G, every fortnight as we sit down with some of your favourite artists,
producers,
and engineers to talk everything music.
Brought to you by Avid Pro Tools.
That sounds great.
Templates are really good if you do sort of similar genres all the time, because you can just start, you know, composing and using the same sounds as well. But even if you're not doing similar genres, it's really good to sort of... There's a saying which is, work sideways before working down.
Okay.
Have you heard of that?
No, don't think so. Mm.
But I think it's important. I think in most things for songwriting and production, to work sideways and get the, you know, the arrangement done before obsessing over the sound design is
quite
important.
See. Oh, no, 100%. I mean, how many times have I found myself like playing around with an idea and then I'm poring over, you know, obscure reverb parameters and I'm thinking, oh, you're missing the point. You're missing the point. But I think we've all done that one, yeah. No, good call, good call.
Do you have different sort of heads or hats, rather, for different approaches? For example, if you're doing more creative work and you're writing, you don't really want to be mixing, right? Because I often find I have to allocate an afternoon for mixing or, you know, a different day for production versus songwriting, because I feel like I'm in a completely different head state when I'm doing that.
I know what you mean. I mean, I don't write, but I get the idea of switching between different mindsets. You know, if I'm, for example, if I was doing in the middle of track laying a load of sound effects in a film and I'm really in the mindset for that, I can't just then easily switch to, I don't know, editing a video or doing something totally different. Or I even noticed once that after I'd been teaching Pro Tools, I was in a really super technical mindset. And then I went around to see my mum and I was kind of still thinking in technical terms. And I had to think, right, I'm not talking to students anymore. I'm talking to my mum. I shouldn't be thinking of like technical stuff and talking in this way, you know. So there's a kind of transitional sort of period.
I think possibly my favourite story to do with that is that there's a thing that that we tend to do if we need to make an edit for some reason of before picking up, and I do this if I'm making a screen cap video or something like that, is I'll go 3, 2 and then start talking again.
Right.
And the reason I do that is, I mean, it's not to do with kind of the noise, the numbers aren't significant. It's just there's two little kind of like waveform blobs that you can do, and they're quite easy to spot. Some people click their fingers and clap and whatever, and they're probably better ideas, but I don't do that. I'd been having a very difficult morning trying to get a video just right, and just over and over again trying to get it and messing up and whatever. And then I just went into the house and just kind of like go in, greet my partner, and I said, and instead of going, you know, good morning or something like that, I said 3, 2, good morning.
Oh no! Right.
It's so funny. And,
yeah, definitely had my head in my previous mindsets.
Yeah, I've got a story that's along those lines a little bit. I was sitting at the computer for ages doing stuff, you know. And then I went downstairs and I can't remember, I was carrying something and I accidentally dropped it. And my first thought was, rather than picking it up, Command Z.
Really?
No, yeah. If you're talking about some kind of undo buffer on Reality, hey, I'm sign me up, I want that.
Command Z.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think I've referred to defrosting something in the microwave to unfreeze. As well,
right?
And like, yeah, we need to unfreeze that.
Okay, all right.
I'm not sure. How you do
yeah,
that.
we need to be careful, don't we? Okay. I mean, let's talk about recording, production, mixing tricks. The things that you do that you just kind of think, yeah, that's a good idea. I'll remember that and do it again sometime. I know, Paul. What are you, sort of like, you know, anything outside of the computer? Let's kind of pin that on it now that you found helpful in the past.
Mixing tricks that outside of the computer.
Yeah, mixing or recording or, you know, it doesn't just have to be mixing.
Yeah, I think if for example, I was in a recording scenario where I've got voiceover artists in or somebody who's in the voiceover booth, I suppose one of the tricks is just about making sure that they're completely comfortable when they first go in. And I'm not just talking about the temperature and having water, but I'm talking about making sure that they're comfortable in the scenario with, you know, whoever's in there with the clients and so on, you know. So I'll try and put them at ease to begin with, and it really depends on the person, but having a conversation with them, not pushing them to get it done too quickly, you know, letting them go in their own time, giving them time to practice, and trying to take the pressure off a little bit while still making sure that we keep broadly on track with the session, but trying to set them at ease in the sense that they can read the script in a way which works. And what I mean by that is, if you're trying to rush something or someone feels unduly under pressure, they're not going to give the best performance. I'm sure you can relate to this with working with vocalists.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Trying to make sure it's a seemingly comfortable, relaxing setting, and that, you know, they can just get it done.
Non-judgmental, laugh everything off.
Yeah.
It really, really helps.
Yeah. And if they get into a bit of a flap and they're thinking, oh, I can't get this right, you know, you've got to say, oh, don't worry about it, you know, let's just give it another go. Or do you want a drink? Or do you want to come out of the booth for a minute? And you just make it seem like it doesn't really matter and that the pressure isn't on them. That helps a lot.
That's incredibly important. And also I say to a lot of, usually if they're quite young and they're stressing about tuning and things like that, because tuning can be fixed, but performance can't. So I say, look, it's so easy to fix your tuning. So please just focus on relaxing and performing really well. But literally outside of the studio, I don't know if this counts, but a lot of mix engineers swear by listening outside the door of the studio.
Oh, so yeah, actually, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, identify the levels more easily, right? Because you're not sort of so obsessed with the detail. It's almost like mixing in mono first.
Yeah, and not looking at the screen. So even if you were in the room, look away, close your eyes, turn the screen off, whatever. And that can help a lot because of the visual distraction of seeing the, you know, DAW with all the waveforms and everything and the levels on screen. I find that's a distraction.
Yeah, because you can obsess over what looks correct rather than what sounds good.
I refer everybody to my article a couple of days ago about things we should stop worrying about. Or I forget what the title ended up being. It certainly wasn't the original title. But the last thing on the list was things that you can see but can't hear. And yeah, exactly that kind of thing about, I mean, it's so easy to convince yourself that an edit's bad if you can see where the edit is. That kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, absolutely.
RSPE Audio Solutions, design, sell, and install professional audio and video equipment. Their team are available by phone, live chat, or email to receive and process orders. They have everything you need to build or upgrade your home studio to ensure you can continue to work from home. If there is anything they can do to help, reach out or shop online at rspeaudio.com.
Something I quite like, actually, is this is very much kind of like born out of necessity rather than choice. But what can be quite a nice thing is I've got a couple of sort of microphone choices, which are sort of based around just kind of like trying stuff because it's what I had. I mean, there are a few different ones. I mean, I think people can be very kind of conventional in their choices, and I get that because it's a known quantity. You know, I mean, I've said various unkind things in the past about the SM57, you know, and I don't think you're allowed to say that on the internet. You'll get a significant pushback from people telling you that your opinion is not justifiable, put it that way. And actually, it's never been a criticism of the microphone. It's been a criticism of people's attitude towards it, of like, it's such a known thing about, you know, this is what you use for. And it's like, well, it can be. You know, but you know, you can use anything you want, really. You know, there's nothing magic about that one. And although even saying that can be controversial. But anyway, moving it away from that particular, you know, that particular microphone. Something I've used really successfully on electric guitar cabinets, for example, is the Sennheiser E609 the little stubby clip-on TomTom mic that you see all over the place on sort of, you know, for live sound.
Oh yeah.
And they're really and I'm just like, yeah, nothing I don't like about that. It works extremely well, but it's because it's so compact as well, it doesn't get in the way at all, and there's quite often some left over. This kind of came to me to be a bit of a thing when I got access to some kind of nicer microphones to put on the toms and had these lying around. And very often there's like, oh, I've got a spare mic, I'll stick something else on. Usually in context with something else, you know, different flavour, blend, and you can get lost in that stuff about blending microphones on guitar cabinets. But having something else to stick on to see how it goes, absolutely, you know. And I mean, there's quite a few examples of things like that where using something that's a little bit unconventional for something other than what it's for, just because, you know, it's not a rule, you don't have to use.
Yeah, trying not to get into your own kind of rules where you think, right, this is what I do, you know, try and vary it a little bit from, you know, week to week. So for example, like everyone might have their own favorite EQ or favorite compressor, which is natural, you know, you find things that work, but every so often I'll think, right, I'm deliberately going to use a different EQ that I hardly ever look at just to see if I like it, you know, to try it out. And, you know, you might find that there's something good in there.
Have fun and experiment. for these things. That maybe I'll say the I quoted it on the last podcast, but I think it's really important because it keeps coming up. It's that saying, learn the rules like a pro so you can break them like an artist.
Right.
It's I think a lot of it is knowing when to use sort of formula and rules, but also knowing when to break them, because you do know your craft so well that you can break it. It can be incredible and a lot more impressive than just sort of doing everything by the book.
Exactly. Yeah. You can't just follow a prescribed way of doing it all the time. You know, some of the greatest tracks ever recorded have no doubt been done with unconventional techniques.
Mm. I mean, that was one of mine. We should go to one of you guys. Anyway, what I was going to do another.
I mean,
come on.
Do you want to go to the question of how's your approach changed since you entered into this industry? Not really.
I mean, no. I mean, I'm just wondering. I mean, if we're talking about me, I kind of do less.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a good thing. It's that whole thing about embarrassment of riches. You've got a load of toys, you want to use them all. And you get over with that. My favourite story about this is the first time I really wanted a digital delay in my kind of, I mean, sorry, a digital reverb in my sort of Porter Studio days, you know. I had a little cassette tracker and whatever, and I'd seen digital reverbs, and I just thought it was just the best thing ever. And I just thought, I want one. I didn't have one. And the first time I got some, alone time with a digital reverb. Yeah, I mean, you know, I went in hard. And I think some of those reverbs are still decaying somewhere, like kind of, you know, from like 1993 or something, you know. But basically, you've got to get it out of your system. You absolutely have to. And there's no point. I used to teach, you know, and I mean, there's no point telling somebody, no, you can't do that. You mustn't do that. No, you mustn't use that because, you know, it's too complicated. It's not for you, or, you know, it's, I mean, actually you probably shouldn't use that because you'll make a terrible mess with it. And that's probably, but you have to make the mess. You have to. And as long as you do it in private, when it doesn't matter, you know, then that's not a problem at all. And why should someone try to stop them from doing it? But when you get that stuff out of your system, I mean, we talk endlessly on the blog about I had loads and loads of plugins on my computer and I don't use any of them, so I got rid of them. And I mean, this is all very true. But the thing about it really is just kind of like the stuff that really makes a difference is the stuff that you can't really do anything about with plugins.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Mm. It's the emotion, just interviewing people on this podcast, it always comes back to emotion and you know, getting the listener to feel a certain way. And whatever tools you use, they have to have that effect, really. And if you can delete things, if you can make it as simple as possible, that should be the main focus, right?
There's an interesting thing here of definitely. Just kind of like old recording. That bloody seagull. Excuse me.
I can hear it.
Right, back in the room. I had the door open because it's been nice, but yeah. Story of my life. It's a thing I think about sometimes, of just kind of like, we have records that we absolutely revere, which are kind of like less than hi-fi. Mm. And it's very easy to attribute what's so great about those records to the sound of those old records and the you know, technical deficiencies which add vibe and flavour and are brilliant about them. A really good example might be, I mean, if you listen to, I tell you what, I love the sound of Al Green. That sort of classic Al Green records, and you've got these kind of like dusty hi-hats, and it's all quite, it's very kind of like fuzzy and warm and nice, and, you know, squawky little mid-rangey horns and, you know, that stuff, and a little bit of Hammond poking out doing some fluty noises that's just kind of, and it sounds very distant, and, you know, and it's a lovely, lovely sound. But honestly, I think you could record that stuff straight into Pro Tools through a bunch of AAA interfaces, and it would still be absolutely brilliant, because it's not the sound. That helps, sure. Mm-hmm. That's a really nice feature of it, but it's not what makes it good.
No.
And this is really the thing of kind of like, I remember years ago working with a friend of mine, and he'd done this very peculiar kind of recording of like an acoustic guitar thing, and he just recorded it onto a cassette recorder in front of him, and we tried to sort of do it again a few times, never got there. Very odd thing it got was he had untrimmed guitar string ends poking out from his headstock, and it's quite a sort of like moody sort of piece, and a couple of them were jangling together and were knocking against the cassette recorder in this kind of quite unpredictable way. And it really added a load of sort of like spookiness and sort of vibe to the thing. And it was really interesting. I mean, it's a kind of happenstance. But the recording itself was awful, but it worked.
Mm.
And it didn't work because it was awful. That's the important point I'm making, is kind of like there's a real distinction here of like it worked well because it was a
awful.
Great performance, you know. And yeah, and he couldn't do it again when, you know, and one of those things. Anyway, there's a lot of me. What do you guys think?
I mean, I've learnt that it's really important to have fun, really, with what you're doing. If you're writing or recording, and it's important that everyone else is having fun. So collaboration is really important as well. And if everyone's having fun and you're listening and you're tapping your foot, then that's what we want, because the listener needs to enjoy it, right? If something's too much hard work, then you might want to rethink whether it's worth putting the work into, because everything is supposed to be fun and enjoyable with this, really.
Yeah. Do you think it's sometimes difficult to have fun when it's really pressurized? Does it get like that, or is that entirely within your control?
I mean, there's a difference between the pressure of delivering something, and when it gets to mixing, it can get, you know, tiring as well with listening to the same thing over and over again. But I often find that the best tracks that I work on, I'm still enjoying, you know, after listening hundreds and hundreds of times, I'm still enjoying it, if that makes sense. And the ideas sort of flow a lot more easily than something that's not good.
Yeah. And do you think you've got a good sense of when something's going to be well received? As in, do you think you can listen to something you're working on thinking people are going to love this?
I can now. Right. Yeah. But that's been a process. And I think it's important to be really, really honest with yourself, which is why I do the test of the groggy morning test, and also playing your track against other references, you know, on Spotify, and then listening back to your own track. And if you genuinely, if there's a drop in quality, whether that's mixing or whether that's, you know, just composition or songwriting quality, then you have to be honest with yourself and keep working, really.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe listen at different times. Do you think if you mix something kind of late at night and you think it's great, it's probably not a good idea to commit to it until you've had a listen the following day?
Definitely don't deliver a mix late at night. That's what I would say.
Yeah.
Oh, we've all had those "what was I thinking" moments.
Yeah. I think in terms of changes in approach over the course of the time I've been working, I mean, one big difference obviously is that I've gone from working as someone who is just employed, working for a business full time, to being self-employed. But also with that, I suppose over time came an improvement, or, you know, kind of change in my confidence level, where if I was working with someone previously, a client, and they said, "Oh, can we do this in the mix? You know, can we add this sound effect in?" I would just say, "Yep." And I wouldn't question it. I would just put it in, you know, and whether I thought it was good or not, it would go in. But now I'd be more inclined to say, "Okay, well, we'll try it. And then if I don't think it works, I'll say this, I don't think this is working." You know, I'll be quite happy to say that.
Good.
And usually it's very well received, and quite often they'll say, "Okay, okay, maybe you're right." Or I'll say, "How about this?" I'll say, I know you haven't thought of this and you might not like it, but what about if we do this?" And then I'll show them, because sometimes describing something is one thing, but showing them how it's going to sound is another. And then usually when they hear it, they'll like it, and maybe they'll make a tweak or two, or sometimes they'll just love it straight off, you know. Yeah, that's helped.
I feel like the clients appreciate it, because it feels like you're invested in the track more. If you just say, "Okay, I'll do this," and, you know, it just feels like you're bored and you're just sort of trying to take the money or the job, and you're not really emotionally invested. So it's good when the producer or someone gives creative suggestions, I think.
It is, yeah. And also they feel like that's why they're employing you to do it, you know, because of your expertise. So
exactly.
They want your input on it, because they don't have the knowledge that you do. They have ideas and, you know, other, you know, skills, but they don't have exactly the same skill set that you do. So that's what they're paying for, essentially, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
The only time, every so often you'll encounter a problematic client where they make a load of stupid suggestions. Sometimes if it gets so far down the path of them, they've made a load of ideas and I disagree with them, I'll just, you know, sort of say, "Okay, I'm just going to do what they want now," you know, and I'll just kind of resign myself to the fact that it's something I'm not happy with, and I'll go along with it.
Ask to have your name taken off it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. This is, yeah.
So, it's so sad when that happens, though, because you really don't want to have to get to that stage, but some clients are insistent.
I find this happens sometimes with corporate clients, mostly corporate video clients. And here I'm talking more about the video edit side of things.
What, and they're, you know, and Star Wipe?
Yeah, well, they don't know the difference between a PowerPoint presentation and a video. A video is not a PowerPoint presentation. You don't fill the screen with text. It's a different medium. But sometimes they don't understand that, and you get to the point where you think, oh, okay, let's just go with it now. Yeah. Mm.
A drummer friend of mine, he used to do quite a few debt gigs. He used to describe some of them as being paper bag gigs. And what he meant by that was one where he had a paper bag with eye holes torn in it on his head when he's playing. Just kind of, I'll take the money, but you haven't seen me, right?
Right, yeah, yeah.
Here's a good one. Something that if we're going back to kind of like, you know, workflow tips and staying productive and fresh and all the rest of it. And yes, you know, I'm British and I bribe myself with cups of tea and all the rest of it. I'm not alone there. Something I think's really important is to sort of stay engaged with just kind of very broadly with the medium, the thing that you're creating. And I don't mean the specific project. I don't mean the specific work you're doing, but just the point of all of it. And the single best change I've made in my studio in the last 5 years is I've got piano in it. I don't have a keyboard controller. I've got a piano with speakers in it that I can turn on, and it's away from the computer. And I can just go and sit at it and play it and without being anywhere near the computer, without having to do anything, touch any software. And it just, it's great, because apart from it just being kind of like a nice little thing to kind of like, break things up, maybe give me a break from trips to the kettle, perhaps. The other thing that it does is it keeps me enthused about music.
Yeah.
And that's really important, you know, of just kind of like on its most fundamental level, not a particular recording, not a particular record, not a thing that I might be working on. But just music in its broadest sense of just the fact that you can make noises that over time do something peculiar in the mind of the listener and, you know, engage you in it. Because it's an odd, transitory, intangible thing, music, you know? You know, if you're a visual artist, say, you make a thing and it's there, even when you're not thinking about it or engaging in it, but you press stop, the music's gone. You know? So, I just think that's like a nice one. But really importantly, don't think, oh, I don't need to do that because I've got a keyboard controller and I've got a fantastic sample library plugin or something. You're near your computer. And that's the thing you're trying to get away from for a minute.
It's a bit like that saying, go and touch grass, sort of get back to the fundamentals, get back to basics rather, and sort of remind yourself of what it's all about, really.
Exactly, yeah. Mm. And sort of on that note, you know, getting away from the computer periodically and exercise. Should we just mention a little bit about exercise? I know, you know, it's obvious that you should move around a little bit, but I think exercising a little bit throughout the day and then when you have time properly ties in with the mindset of work, in the sense that if you're disciplined enough to stick to some kind of training plan, you know, however rigorous or not rigorous you might want it to be, that carries across into the mindset for work. So, you know, I like to train, so I do some climbing and a few other activities, and I find that the discipline from that does translate into other areas of work, including the mindset to be focused enough to get things done and work to schedules and be, you know, it's just the discipline, really, that comes across into work.
That's really important. But do you find as well that sometimes if you're too obsessed with schedule, sometimes it can sort of inhibit your ability to do good work? Because I find as well, it's nice to have, working as a freelancer, working from home, you can kind of go with your own schedule a little bit and kind of go with how you feel. And sometimes that's nice as well, because if I've got, I don't know, a mix to deliver or a song that I'm working on, and one day I just feel like I'd rather be more creative than technical a certain day. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. There should be fluidity within it. So it should act more as a guide.
This kind of brings me back to something I was saying right at the beginning about kind of like what a fan I am of paper lists. And the thing that I do when I'm making a list is I always make my list achievable. There's a thing we used to bang on about when I used to teach about SMART target. Any target you set for a student should be SMART, should be specific and time-bound and realistic. And it all rather sucking the fun out of things. But the point is, if you're making a list, don't write everything you've got to do. Write down a few things that you will definitely get done that day. And then that motivates you to because you get the payoff of completing the list. And if it goes really well and you find that you've got a couple of hours left in the end of the day and you can get on with something else, then that's even better. But it's like that thing about over delivering, and you can over deliver to yourself as well. To a client, you know, it doesn't have to work like that. But yeah, we can beat ourselves up, and it's not helpful. It doesn't really achieve anything. You know, the work you get done is the work you get done. So have a nice time doing it.
The Production Expert Podcast is made possible using the new Source Nexus suite from Source Elements, the professional way to collaborate over the internet, along with high definition, low latency audio and video. Need to record an interview or a podcast or collaborate with others for songwriting, review and approval, remote editing and more. With Source Nexus suite, using any browser, you'll get studio quality audio and video, along with custom built tools for seamless integration with your DAW. Pricing starts at free. Get your account today at sourceelements.com.
Awesome. So where are we on this list that we've kind of ignored?
Things that you wish you knew when you first started out. Is there anything that you can think of?
I want to say I should have bought a house in the early 90s.
Or you should have bought, you know, Amazon shares or something.
Yeah.
I've got one on this. It's similar to a point I made earlier. And it's, you know, people who are, just because someone's older than you or has been doing something for longer doesn't mean that they know, you know, infinitely more than you. There can still be things that you know that they don't know. And so I think one thing that I would never say, you know, when sometimes people use the length of time they've been doing something as a reason why they are superior in knowledge.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I've been doing this 30, don't tell me how to do it. I've been doing it 30 years. Yeah, but you might have been doing it 30 years wrong.
Exactly.
Or you might have been doing it really well. So, you know, if you take two, let's use musicians, we're talking about piano. Let's take two pianists, right? Someone started learning piano 30 years ago. Someone else did 30 years ago. That doesn't mean that they are of comparable playing ability, you know, because one of them could be, you know, a seasoned concert pianist, and another one could be just someone who has a go at the local pub every so often. And it's the same with anything, isn't it? It's the same with audio engineering. You know, the length of time doesn't immediately mean that
you're the ultimate authority. You can learn from everyone's perspectives as well. Someone might have a really fresh kind of out-of-the-box thinking style that you can learn from, which is why I think collaboration is really important as well, because we can't be great at everything. It's good to learn how to mix and master and do all these things because it helps with the decision-making process. But, you know, we can't be experts at all of these things at once, I don't think. It's very difficult, unless you're Prince, of course.
Well, he was recording, he was playing all the instruments, he was producing it, mixing it, you know. So, yeah, that you can't be Prince. but also, yeah, I'd be happy to learn from someone, you know, who was relatively new to the industry if they had an idea that I hadn't thought of, you know. And that sometimes happens, you know, because I still do some teaching and a student might say, oh, you know, what about this? And I think, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't considered that.
Didn't you say that, Julian, that you often learned from your students?
Oh, when I used to teach, I mean, I've done some guest lectures since I stopped teaching, and specifically just to go and, you know, like, talk to some young people and get some and just get what's going on with them, you know, just because, yeah, absolutely. Every session I ever taught, I got more from than the students did. And that sounds like because I was terrible, and I might have been. But the point is, actually, you know, there's no such thing as a daft question. And, you know, you need to hear these questions. You need to get a fresh perspective, you know. Sometimes it could be nothing as interesting as somebody just kind of, like, having heard what you just said, saying, yeah, but why? And it's like, oh, you know, it kind of gets annoying if they keep going on that line. But the first one.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. What I'd say, actually, something I wish I'd known, is that the more experienced and the more I'm trying to avoid the word accomplished, because it's not about accomplishments, it's about experience and kind of established, that's a much better word,
people are
in the industry, the nicer they tend to get.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people who are right at the beginning of their careers can be actually quite hostile, and what it comes from is a lack of security.
Yeah.
And yeah. basically people feeling some sort of, you know, implied competition, must be best, you know. Whereas like people who are kind of, you know, just through that stuff and just kind of perfectly comfortable with where they are actually really generous.
I found that the people at the real top of their game are so sort of not. It's not necessarily humility that they have, but it's just the niceness, like you say, Julian.
What it is they don't judge you.
Yes,
in the way that
exactly.
other people do. They, you know, you can talk to somebody who is like, you know, multiple Grammy, amazing person. And you know, usually you'll find talk to these people, they talk to you on the level.
Yeah.
They see you as like them and you're just going, well, you're wrong, but I'll go with that because this is a nice conversation. You know, it's yeah. that's I wish I'd known that, because basically the industry is full of nice people doing stuff that they like, largely, that you find the occasional outlier. And just see them as exactly that, an outlier. That's not how the world is. It's just like it's just a little bump in the world.
And you know, I think that's why it is because obviously they have the experience of knowing that, you know, this is all sort of, it's all about perspective. No one's really that amazing without the help of other people. But also they love what they do and they've had success by loving what they do. And I think it's just really important in order to achieve success, you just have to be passionate and be happy and really enjoy what you do.
Yeah, I don't think you can ever be really good at something if you're not into it, you know.
Yeah.
If you're just doing it for the sake of having a job, then you're not going to be the best. It's not possible.
Awesome. It feels like it might be... I've got no idea how long I've been talking for, which is usually a good sign, but do you feel like it's time to go to Find of the Week?
I think so, yes.
Let's do that. Let's go to Find of the Week.
Yes. Paul, what's your Find of the Week?
So my Find of the Week is a pair of headphones, which I'm wearing right now, which are the Beyer DT700 Pro X. So these are the successor to the 770 Pro. And I never actually owned a pair of those, but I've used them many times. And I was in the market for a decent set of headphones. Previously, I was, believe it or not, using Sennheiser HD25s, which are reasonable, but...
You know, not comfortable for a long time, though.
Exactly. Yeah, so I looked around and I found these, and they're excellent. You know, they are really comfortable. They sound great. And they've actually got a low impedance as well, which means that you can drive them from anything. You know, you could potentially plug these into a mobile device and still get decent level out of them. So that's my...
And they'll be loud as well, presumably.
They are. I mean, I've not cranked it to test that, but... there's no problem with the level out of them. Yeah, really good.
Do you know what impedance they are? Is that going to...
Yeah, the impedance is 48 ohms.
Oh, okay, all right, yeah.
I think the previous ones were... They were available in three different impedance levels.
Beyer do that, yeah.
Yeah, so it was never... It was never kind of a jack of all trades. You chose the one that was applicable to whatever you were going to use it for, but this one covers most bases, you know. It's really... good set of headphones.
It does kind of make a difference. I mean, if this is something that anyone's kind of not particularly across, I remember I did a bit of an explainer about the effect of headphone impedance when I did a piece testing the Neumann, what they called NHD, are they the 20s? Closed back ones, the ones they brought out first. But anyway, because they were high impedance headphones. And kind of, yeah, what difference is it making? There's a bit of an explainer about that in there. So, but yeah.
It's important to understand because... If you just buy a set of headphones, not knowing that that's a thing, you could get it wrong and you can't get enough level, or you know, they're not the right ones for the job.
Shay, what's yours?
Yeah, I mean, if anyone wants to get some great plugins at 70% discount, then head over to Plugin Boutique. There's actually one that I've got my eye on, which is the PSP Binamp Saturation plugin, and so that was actually £85 and it's now £25 until the end of April. So I'm definitely going to get that. It's got that lovely tube warmth kind of analog vintage style saturation, and you can use it on anything: vocals, bass guitar, drums, all those things. And I'm always on the lookout for a great saturation plugin. So the Binamp is really nice from PSP.
And I see it's got a testimonial from some bloke called Dom Morley. So
who's that? I don't know who that is at all.
This is like the preamplifier from the Echo Rec. Now, an Echo Rec something. I mean, is it? Somebody does a plug-in of the Echo Rec.
That is it. Yeah.
Is it? But anyway, the Echo Rec is like a tape delay, but it uses like a disc instead, and it's like this metal disc that it records onto, and it's basically all over kind of the classic kind of like Dave Gilmour, Pink Floyd stuff.
Yes. This has been modelled after the Echo Rec.
I'm just total delay junkie, so anything like that. But that's, if you're talking about like kind of like cool delay sounds, then yeah. Awesome. That is me then, isn't it? Going to call out a thing that Sound on Sound did recently. They did a podcast bringing together people who were like instrumental in the creation and launch of the Yamaha DX7, because it's the 40th anniversary. Is that sound right? I don't know. It was a really interesting listen, full of kind of just information that just kind of, I mean, I think we all know that that was a very successful product, but I didn't know how successful. I knew it was like rewrite the rule book kind of successful, but the numbers were just extraordinary. And just everything. And they had like John Chowning on it, who kind of like basically invented FM synthesis and all this. Really interesting listen. So, yeah, it kind of inspired something that I'm writing at the moment, actually, this morning, which kind of like picks up on that. And that's like one example on a few different things. Anyway, that's just another article. It isn't finished yet, so I won't talk about it. But really good podcast. I mean, the Sound on Sound podcasts are quite good. I mean, you know, there are podcasts and there are podcasts, aren't there? But
almost as good as this.
Right? I wasn't going to say it, but... with this thing, it's just kind of like, it's one of those things that they do a load of synthy stuff that, to be honest, I'm not usually that across. You know, I'm a bit of a synth nerd, but not that much. But this one just looked too good because of who was on it. And it really, really good. Really, really good. Worth a listen. So there's a link to that in the show notes.
Fantastic.
That's all we've got time for this week. Thank you to Ashay. Thank you to Paul. We'll be back next week with another edition of the Production Expert Podcast.